If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Whether you're fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet, or deep in the ocean casting nets, fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Fish Nerds, a show about fish, fishing, and eating fish. I'm Clay Grove, Chief Executive Fish Nerd, licensed fishing guide, and your best friend. This show is always interesting, usually funny, and mostly true. This will be our last show of 2020. We did it. We got through one more year of podcasting, and I think it's 7 years deep now. And the Fish Nerds themselves are turning 10 in January, and I think we're going to rekindle our book project. We started it 10 years ago. Dave Kelm and I started it, and we never finished it. We may kick that book out of the desert of Google Docs and put it out in the world for you guys to check out. We'll see if I can get Dave on board with doing that. But today on the podcast, we've got a very exciting show for you. I'm pretty excited about this one. Tim Beat, one of my favorite humans on earth, is here with a new essay about the joys of podcasting and making a YouTube channel. And we love Tim so much. And his daughter, Grace, is pure joy. You'll hear that coming up next. After Tim Beat, my daughter Zoe is going to be on the show. And we went out fishing the other day and caught a brook trout right through the ice. And she cooked it. And we're doing a little cooking segment on planking a brook trout. It's going to be delightful. And I'm joined by Lawrence Dorsey, the Piedmont Region Fisheries Research Coordinator from the Inland Fisheries Division for North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission. And he's going to be with us, and we're going to talk all things North Carolina fishing and do the news for you as well. Hold on tight. We got a big show. You're going to love this one. Let's start with Tim Beat.
I remember in August 1981 when MTV came on the air. The very first music video they played was Video Killed the Radio Star. The song included the lyrics, "And now we meet in an abandoned studio. We hear the playback and it seems so long ago." Recording a podcast can sometimes feel like that. We sit in our basements with mics on and doors closed to talk about the topics we love: fish, fishing, and eating fish. It takes a lot of work to be always interesting, usually funny, and mostly true. Well, the mostly true part isn't a lot of work, but the others are. There are so many fishing YouTube stars making gobs of cash with their GoPro cameras and sponsors and free gear that somehow making a podcast can seem a little old-fashioned. You don't get to see Clay Groves doing a taste test of real tuna compared to a plant-based tuna substitute, but you sure can hear him chewing as he shoves a quarter of a sandwich into his mouth and chomps an inch away from his mic. But even though many famous YouTubers have millions of subscribers and probably earn $100 a cast while they're fishing, I kind of like the old-school nature of podcasts. And I wonder whether, despite their significant wealth, some of those famous YouTubers might feel unfulfilled because the one thing they haven't accomplished is being interviewed by Clay Groves on the Fish Nerds podcast. It's kind of like the 1972 song, "Cover of the Rolling Stone," by Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. In the song, the band lamented that they had achieved everything except getting their picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone magazine. Yeah, maybe some of those famous YouTubers feel the same way about never having been on the Fish Nerds podcast. I wonder.
Well, we're big YouTubers, we've got lots of followers, and we're loved everywhere we go. Talk about fishing and we talk about lures. Get cash for videos. We have mad fishing skills that give us all kinds of thrills. But the thrill we've never known is to be broadcast on the Fish Nerds Podcast. Be interviewed by Clay Grove.
By Clay Grove.
Wanna hear my voice on the podcast?
Grove.
Then I'd no longer be an outcast.
Grove.
Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove. I go fishing daily, even when it's rainy. Got the best boat you ever seen. Making YouTube videos is easy, just like a cash machine. Now it's all designed to blow our minds, but our minds won't really be blown. Like a nerdy blast when you're on the podcast being interviewed by Clay Grove.
By Clay Grove.
Wanna hear my voice on the podcast?
Grove.
Then I no longer be an outcast.
Grove.
Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove. Podcast, then I no longer be an outcast. Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove.
Being interviewed by Clay Grove.
Wanna hear my voice on the podcast. Then I no longer be an outcast. Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove.
Thank you, Tim. That was so much fun. And Grace, you're an amazing human, and I really appreciate that. I was needing a pick-me-up here at the end of the year, and that song did it for me. I can't believe you. The idea that someone would sing, being interviewed by Clay Groves, kills me so much. Thank you so much for doing that for me. Let's jump right into our cooking segment with my daughter Zoe, who just turned 13 years old. And we went ice fishing the other day, Christmas Eve, in fact. We went ice fishing for brook trout, and she caught her first brook trout through the ice, and we decided to murder it for you. I'm in my kitchen with Zoe.
Hi.
Say hi, Zoe.
Hello.
The other day, we went ice fishing for brook trout and caught one, and we're going to cook this one. Before we cook it, Zoe, let's talk about how we catch a brook trout through the ice. Tell me about our brook trout fishing technique.
So what we do is we go to 1 foot of water, and we sit down and we just jig and wait for the schools of brook trout to come around to us. And when they do, they're going to just like go underneath the hole and try to hit your bait. And it takes a couple tries for them to hit it, and then they'll hit it and you take them out of the water.
Tell me about what kind of bait did we use?
I used a mop fly that I tied. It was my first tie I've ever done.
What color?
Pink and yellow.
Yeah, that was green and red.
It was pink and yellow.
Okay, pink and yellow. I thought it was chartreuse and fuchsia.
No, you didn't.
Yeah. Okay, so our recipe here we're making today is called spiced cedar planked salmon with maple bourbon glaze. We're swapping the salmon for a brook trout, and we filleted this, and we did what's called butterflying it, which is when you take the backbone and bones out and lay it flat. We took a plank of, well, usually you can use cedar, but actually I used a plank of maple, soaked it in water for about 2 hours, and we laid it on the plank skin side down. Zoe made the rub, and Zoe, tell us what's in the rub.
It's a rub of chili powder, onion powder, garlic powder, smoked paprika, salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper. And what we're going to do is we're going to rub this all over the fish. Zoe's doing it right now. She's rubbing it all over the fish right now. And we're going to let it sit on the fish until it kind of self-moistens, about 10 minutes. And while that's going, we're going to make a maple bourbon glaze. Yeah, rub it right in. Do a lot of it right on there.
What's it feel like?
It feels like ocean sand because it has salt in it.
And it already smells really good.
It also, I tasted it, and it tastes really strong firstly, because I just had it about, like, a lot of it, but then it's really good.
Yeah, and we're going to do is we're going to rub this in really good, let it sit for 10 minutes, put more on the sides here, Zoe. And we're going to make our bourbon glaze, and the bourbon glaze is made with about 6 tablespoons of bourbon and 3/4 cups of maple syrup. We make our own maple syrup, but we don't make our own bourbon.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you like bourbon?
I don't want to.
You'll be tasting it today, but as a glaze. We'll cook alcohol out. All right, back in a minute. Talk about our bourbon glaze. Okay, so now we're making our bourbon glaze, and all this is bourbon and maple syrup. Zoe, how's it smell?
Absolutely disgusting.
Are you telling me you don't drink bourbon?
Yeah.
We're going to let this boil for about 10 minutes. Should we reduce about half and become a nice, thick, gooey syrup, like a candy almost?
Gross, I think.
Well, we'll see. And then while this is heating up, we're going to start the grill and get the grill good and hot. So we put this plank on there, it goes. And the fish is resting, and that rub we put on there is all turning like wet looking, which is what we want to do.
Yes, it is.
Looks good, doesn't it? Have you eaten trout before?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Do you like it?
I do. I like fish, except for lake trout.
No one likes lake trout.
Lake trout is awful.
Although I bet you with a good recipe, we're gonna kill a lake trout this year, I promise.
Okay, that sounded really wrong.
All right, back in a minute with the grill. Okay, so we have the maple glaze is done. It's all hot and bubbly and gooey. The trout has absorbed a lot of the rub. Zoe's gonna grab the trout, and I'm gonna grab the glaze, and we're gonna go out to the grill.
Oh, and the glaze now smells good.
Is because the bourbon burned up.
Yep. So now it just smells like maple syrup.
Yeah. So out to the grill we go. The planked salmon. We cut some lemons, too, to heat up with it, because lemons look good.
Man, this smells so good.
Smells good, doesn't it? All right. We're outside now. Grill is good and hot. Come on out, Zoe. We're going to put this plank right on the heat on the grill here. And what we're going to do now is we're going to pour some of that glaze on top of this trout. Bring it out. And we're going to just kind of baby it and just kind of spoon it on like that. You want to do that, Zoe?
Sure.
Okay. It should be a thick, like candy almost.
It's almost candied, yeah. This is going to be amazing. We're eating this for lunch today.
This is lunch.
Oh, yeah.
And with a nice thick piece of slant salmon, it might take 10 minutes to cook, but this is a very thin piece of trout, so I bet we're going to be done in less than 5 minutes.
Honestly, yeah. I've only ever caught tiny salmon. How big do they get?
Lank salmon can get pretty big, but cohos and chinooks can get to like 35, 40 pounds.
Oh, wow. I think we've caught half a pound.
You've caught landlocked Atlantic salmon. Little ones. That looks great. Pour that. You can just pour a little bit on there.
And then I'm going to keep the spoon so it has
lick
a little
the spoon.
And lick it. Yeah. It's the smartest thing to do.
That looks great. All right. That's it. We're going to close the lid. Let it cook.
How long?
Until it's done. The meat should be flaky, and then we'll know it's done. And then we'll do a taste test live. Okay, it's been on the grill about 7 or 8 minutes. The meat is flaky. I put some grilled lemons on top as a garnish. And now we're going to go give it a taste. Let's get it off the grill and get it in the house and find Zoe. Open my door first. Looks really good. Looks really good. All right, Zoe.
Yes.
It's tasting time. What do you think of this?
Yeah. It's gorgeous.
So the board warped a little bit.
Which is fine, and it's dripping.
Yeah, which is good.
Yep.
Now, grab a couple of forks, and let's give it a taste.
Okay, so we have a couple of forks.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go.
All right, and
how do we do this?
So there's going to be a lot of bones in it. What you can do is you can take your fork and stick it in there, and you can drag your fork across the meat. They'll come right off the bone and right off of the skin, and then you can take it a mouthful.
So he's
eating it.
That didn't work.
Got a bone right away.
And skin, too.
And skin. Skin's good.
Mm-hmm. It is.
How's it taste?
Like maple syrup and fish. It's amazing.
It's really
good. And the paprika on it, you can definitely taste. It's so good.
Mm. Again, just drag your fork across like this, Zoe, and...
Here's another bone in my mouth.
You've got the bony spot, bony side.
Mm. Here's
come,
another one.
Come down from this end. There's less bones. Mmm. All right. So...
this is a definite yes recipe. Mm-hmm. Eat this.
So planked brook trout with maple bourbon glaze, and we'll put a recipe up on the show notes for this episode. What do you think?
Delicious.
Do you feel bad about killing this fish still?
No.
Thank you, Zoe, for doing that with me. And you can find it truly was a delightful fish to cook. Maybe I'll do a video on my next trout on how I'll make a YouTube video for Tim on how to butterfly a trout. Maybe I'll learn how to do it without getting the bones all in it, too. So that'll be a lot of fun. And again, thanks, Zoe, for killing that fish with me. I appreciate you.
Okay. Hey, everyone. I love podcasts. Who's got recommendations? And send. That was quick.
Do you like comedy? What about movies? Pop culture?
Yeah.
Do you like animals? What about science?
Well, yeah.
Do you dig plants? What about writing, snacks, rambling, and rant?
Well,
filmmaking, improv, and interviews? Canadians, Australians, voting forecasts, and super views? Ladies, gentlemen, cretins, or comic books? Script reads, bad TV, heads that shook, perfectly big packages popping up, podcasts pointing people to discover other podcasts?
Yes?
Fantastic. Check out the Podfix Network. PodfixNetwork.com. At Podfix on Twitter. official_Podfix on the gram. Plus, check out Podfix Presents, wherever fine podcasts are found. The Podfix Network, artist owned and loved.
Hey guys! Look at that adorable town. There's the classic New England church, the quaint village store, all surrounding that beautiful pond. The sparkling snow-frosted pines. Oh, look, they're ice skating and all those folks ice fishing. This is God's country.
Let's go ice fishing this weekend, please, Dad.
Yeah, let's try something new. We already have all of our warm stuff for skiing. Plus, the kid is actually making plans to put down her tablet for a change.
It's certainly something different, and it sounds really fun. But how?
Hey, I know a few guys. Have you ever thought about hitting the hard water but don't know where to start? I'm Clay, licensed fishing guide, and my partner Vinny and I can get you on and off the ice safely. All you need is warm clothes and a fishing license, and the Fish Nerds Guide Service will do the rest. Go to fishnerds.com for pricing and information. Okay, Fish Nerds, I'm so excited because today on the podcast, I have Lawrence Dorsey, who has more than 20 years of experience as a state agency's fisheries management and research biologist. His work has focused on sport fish populations in reservoirs, rivers, and small impoundments. Lawrence, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Clay. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm excited because our friend Greg, a mutual friend of ours, connected us, and let's do this. Let's talk fishing.
Yes. So
there's a lot you want to talk about. Before the show, I could tell you were doing this brain dump, and I'm like, all right, stop. Let's save it for the show because you couldn't wait to get going.
That's right.
So we're gonna jump right in. I don't care about your whole background and history because no one does. But that's the worst part of any interview. So tell me about yourself.
Yeah.
So we're gonna jump right in. So you're a fisheries biologist, and that's a person that virtually no angler actually really interacts with on a regular basis. What does that mean for you? Like, you do all this great work, but you don't deal with people.
Well, we do deal with people. We have certain things that, for instance, in multiple states and in my state, we'll have what are called creel surveys from time to time where we go out and we ask anglers, how many fish did you catch? What kind of fish did you catch? So we do have some interaction there. We do speak with people. But as I mentioned to you in the pre-show, most state agencies, especially proportionally the number of people that are fishing and just state employees in general in their states, fisheries biologists make up a pretty small number of people in those agencies. And so the chances of you seeing one of us in the field, while it's not impossible, there's a lot of water, there's a lot of places to fish, and there's not many others.
Well, hang on a second. I'm going to tell listeners how they can recognize a field biologist.
Okay.
Right. So if you're out fishing, and you see someone walking around the woods wearing Hunter Orange, not a biologist. If you see someone walking around carrying a fishing pole and has a fishing license on their hat, not a biologist. Biologists have lab coats on and little glasses with tape in the middle, and that's how you can recognize them in the wild.
So, sort of, yeah. Normally, it's we're driving the electric fishing boat, or we're running gill nets, or we're sinking fish attractors somewhere. But again, yeah, we do see people, and I guess probably the place we do see them the most is at the boat ramp, or in one of my former jobs when we would be out stocking trout. Obviously, we'd run into trout anglers a lot that were there. So, but again, in terms of the number of people that are out there fishing across the United States, versus the number of biologists, your chances of an encounter are not as good as they are, would say, maybe, as I mentioned earlier, a law enforcement, a game warden, wildlife officer, conservation officer, depending on what they're called in your state.
Right. Fish police, we call them in some states. Yeah.
So get them.
Get them. Got to get them. So, yeah. So you're a fisheries biologist, and you're really trying to be a resource for anglers. You're collecting data from anglers to make their experience better, right?
Yes, we are. In fact, so some of the things we do are more traditional dealing with fish. For instance, we'll go out and do a survey where we'll collect fish. It's actually what I'm going to be doing tomorrow, working on a reservoir here, collecting fish data, but we also collect data from anglers. We just finished a survey at Lake Gaston, which is a large reservoir on the North Carolina-Virginia border, where we spent a year going around on a rotational basis, interviewing anglers and asking them about their catch, and then also asking them about their opinions.
Oh God!
Well, it's you ask an open-ended question, you know, you never know what you're going to expect,
but also talking to anglers and hoping to tell you the truth.
Yeah, you know, I think that what we see is pretty good compliance, because they realize that, you know, we're out there trying to collect, you know, good information, and it's we make it very clear to them that this is not a law enforcement contact. It's totally science based.
Like fishy Miranda rights for them.
No,
be held out to count a court of law and all that.
No. In fact, that's actually one of the tenets in sort of the science side of that, those studies, is we don't do that, so that, you know, anglers do feel comfortable with us. And typically, if we see something that looks like it's a violation, we'll advise them, hey, if a law enforcement officer were to contact you, you know, this could be a possible violation. And sure, a lot of times they just don't know. But the other thing we're starting to do, we've actually got a small survey we're hoping to step up a notch in one of my work areas, where we have a river that we really can't collect data on very easily because it's pretty shallow, but we know there are kayak anglers out there. And so we're using an online app for them to, when they go out, to tell us how many fish they caught, where they caught, how long they were out. It's about a 15 minute or less survey they take each time. And then they hit send on the iPhone or Android, and it sends it up to the cloud for us, and we can look at those data later. As I said, we just got started on that. So those are some new tools that we didn't have 20 plus years ago when I got into this, obviously, that are helping us engage with anglers a lot more than we used to.
Well, that's amazing. It's funny, because 10 years ago, I went on a quest to catch and eat every kind of freshwater fish in New Hampshire. There's 48 species.
Wow.
And what I did was I called fisheries biologists in the state of New Hampshire and got their survey data. And they had it all on a Google map.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could download that data. And this is before smartphones, you know, were popular.
Right.
If I did it this year, it'd be easy. But that year was hard, because I had to go on a computer, print out the maps, and go find the fish. But so I can imagine, like, the data you collect from anglers, if you can get like even like 20 or 30% of anglers to participate in these citizen science surveys, you can have some remarkable data that you can't get anywhere else.
This is true. It really is. And there are, like I said, there's certain situations, like particularly this river, the Haw River, which is in the central part of North Carolina, that there's not a lot of access for motorboats, and stretches of the river just aren't easy to navigate. So our traditional survey gears, you know, don't work very well there. It's hard.
Do you typically electroshock the fish or net them, or what's your typical collection?
We do a little bit of everything. We do some electrofishing. Most of that works in the spring and the summer. Right now, we just came out of our trap netting season, which is a type of net that really looks like a net with a trap on the end of it. Some other places call it a fike net, F-Y-K-E, that we use for crappie. I'm from North Carolina, so we say crappy here. We're just getting ready, really kind of getting into the meat of our reservoir gill netting season, primarily for striped bass.
So you have freshwater stripers?
We do. We have a stocking program here in a lot of our impoundments. They don't naturally reproduce, but we do have a stocking program where we stock fingerling stripers each year, and then that produces a fishery there.
That must be so much fun.
Yeah, it's one of the dynamics. You know, we're blessed that we do have different dynamics of different fisheries for people that want to go do different things. But we used a variety of gear, but definitely, like I said, we're trying to get a little bit more engaged with anglers and let them know what we do, and also give them the conduit to let them know what their interests are and kind of what's on their mind.
Well, I'm sure you're finding a lot of nerdy fishermen who love sharing information. So I can't wait to hear what kind of data you collect over the next couple of years now that you're doing that.
Right. No, we do. We have some people that are very passionate. They call us. I mean, for instance, we had a survey, what we call an angler diary survey, where we ask people. It's similar to what I just mentioned with the app, except it's the old school where you take a piece of paper out with you and you record how many. And we had several hundred, you know, recordings in this study. It was on catfish on Lake Wylie, and it was really from one guy. He was just super passionate. That was his home lake. That's what he liked to fish for, was catfish. And he was more than willing to write down the length and the weight of every catfish he caught for about a year. And so it was really impressive to see that somebody was that passionate about it.
Oh, that's cool. Now, we're going to cycle back to this in the news in a little bit, because I've got a news story related to this. But okay. We're not going to go into it deep now, because I want to talk about catch and release fishing and how we track those with fisheries biologists, but save that for a bit.
Sure.
The other problem you guys are having in North Carolina is people love moving fish around. We call them bucket biologists. They're people who think that they know more than the fisheries biologists, and they catch a crappie and they want to move that to a lake that doesn't have any crappie, and they put it in a bucket, drive it over there and dump it in the water. That's happening like crazy right now in North Carolina.
Yeah, it actually is. You know, the problem that we're having right now, and let me back up and say that fisheries biologists and fisheries managers in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, as hatchery technology got better and better, and even maybe before that, but that's really probably the heyday of it. We're really good at producing fish and moving them around ourselves. And we moved some fish around back in the day that we shouldn't have moved around.
Well, you see that nationally. Like everywhere you go, you see that as the case. You know, there's in New Hampshire, for example, we have a book I've read called The Bassing of New Hampshire. And it's the history of like every fish that got moved around the state. And like we have no native fish, you know, like four native species and like 44 invasive fish because of this, like, hey, let's throw that, you know, they were throwing Chinook salmon into the Winnipesaukee, Lake Winnipesaukee, to see if they would stay, you know.
Right.
Does it work? Nope. All right. Put something else in there.
And that was repeated in North Carolina, New Hampshire, you name the state. Yeah.
Everywhere.
And so, but what we've seen lately, at least in our part of the world in the Southeast, is a species of fish called the Alabama bass.
What is that?
Yeah. So historically it was thought of being a subspecies of spotted bass. Which spotted bass are a little more common. Some people call them Kentucky bass. Their official name is spotted bass.
You're not helping me at all.
Okay. So they're in the same family, as largemouth and smallmouth.
Okay. So they're sunfish.
Yeah, they're a micropterist. They're a temperate bass is what they are.
Temperate bass were like stripers and white perch and...
Those are...
And largemouth bass and smallmouth bass and sunfish were all in the sunfish families.
Yeah, I'm probably struggling a little bit with my nomenclature right now. But they're in the Micropterus genus. So Micropterus salmoides is largemouth bass, which everybody's familiar with. Dolomieu is smallmouth. The spotted bass is really native to the Midwestern part of the United States, all the way kind of over into North Carolina, into the Mississippi drainage.
They're like a skinny largemouth.
They do. They don't get as big as largemouth, the actual spotted bass. Now, this is where the Alabama bass comes in. So the Alabama bass is now genetically distinct from the spotted bass. But at one point, as I said, it was a subspecies.
Okay.
The Alabama bass, in its native range, which is the Alabama River drainage, which starts out in Georgia, goes in through Alabama, and winds up in Mississippi, that whole Mobile Bay drainage area there. They do get larger than, or as large as some largemouth bass. So you can see a 4 to 5 pound Alabama bass. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where they became attractive to anglers, is it was something different. The habitats down there are a little different. So some of our lakes, largemouth bass don't do as well because of the habitat. They're clearer lakes. They don't have as many nutrients in them. And so the idea was, well, you know, if they're not working out, let's move the Alabama bass up here. And that has been played out in several different scenarios across the Southeast, including North Carolina. And we've seen things like in our lakes where we just had largemouth bass, we're starting to see, you know, our largemouth bass just kind of disappear more or less, or at least be restricted to certain areas of the lake, and a fishery that's now dominated by Alabama bass.
Let me ask you a question. So are largemouth native to North Carolina?
They are. At least the records indicate they are.
New Hampshire, they're not. And we have them everywhere, but they're not native up here. So I'm just curious. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of those species as well that's been moved around to a lot of places, as you well know. Mm-hmm. But the other thing we're seeing, which probably for a lot of people in a lot of situations is as troubling or even more troubling, is, so as I mentioned, it's a competition thing with the largemouth. It's just straight up competition.
Sure.
But with smallmouth and with some of the endemic bass species that live in the streams and on the Georgia-Alabama line, like shoal bass and Swanee bass and
I have a lot of Chattahoochee. Googling to do.
Choctaw bass, yeah.
So
what, particularly with smallmouth, that's the one we've seen in reservoirs. Alabama bass hybridized with them.
Okay.
And what you see at first is you see these hybrids that people call mean mouths because they're a cross between an Alabama bass and a smallmouth bass.
I love that name so much.
Yeah. And there are, you know, they're good fish to catch, but eventually what you see is over time, that hybridization continues to occur, and that Alabama bass just water down the smallmouth bass gene pool till there's no smallmouth bass left. And that's actually occurred in several reservoirs that are up in North Georgia. Blue Ridge is one of them. I believe Chattoog is the one that borders North Carolina that definitely happened in. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big concern of ours because, you know, once these fish get in these systems, we really can't get them out.
No.
There's no way to get them out. And we can't stock our way out of the problem because we're just not going to produce enough fish that would survive. And the Alabama bass are just going to keep reproducing the whole time. We would be stocking something else. So
I was going to say, like, if a fish can reproduce naturally in a system they're put into, they're going to outcompete things because they don't need to be managed. They would just keep making more of themselves. And things like bass, you know, their mouths are so big, they can eat nearly everything. So they just...
Yeah, and Alabama bass are very aggressive, and they're very much a habitat generalist, which also, again, makes them very good in the competition sense. So I guess really the take-home message that I would say to folks is, you know, if you go somewhere and you catch a fish that you like, either do one of two things, either take it home and eat it, mm-hmm. Which is certainly okay if the rules allow it, if they're legal within the rules, or release it at the location that you caught it. That's certainly okay too. There's a few little situations out there. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the whole snakehead.
Oh yeah.
Deal and you know, where they ask people to take them, not release them at all. And so there are those cases, but for the most part, we would say release the fish on site or take it home and eat it. Don't move it. And, right. And I think
that's illegal in most states. Like most states have laws about moving fish.
Correct. And we do as well. We have one as well. But as you can imagine, that's kind of a daunting task when it only takes a few fish to be moved to start a huge problem. So we definitely do as well and advise people of that. You know, it's illegal, but there's a legal side of it. And then there's just the ecological side of it as well.
Right. And there's a good amount of anglers who don't care about what's legal. They're going to do what they want to do.
Yeah, I wouldn't know how to put a number on that.
Seven. It's seven anglers.
Yeah. But I would just say that, and I think some people are well intentioned when they do it. They don't have malintentions. I think they just, you know, do it because they think, well, it's okay.
I understand the inclination to do it. Like, I have a lake nearby me where there's no fish in it, and all the lakes around are full of fish. And I'm like, there's been times where I've thought, gosh, if someone else, not me, would just move some fish around, I'd be so happy. So I understand why someone might want to do it, but yeah, it's a bad idea.
Yeah. And what I would say in that situation, if you're curious about why there are no fish in the lake or what could survive there, or what your options are, contact your state fisheries biologist for the area. You know, if you contact the main office, even if you don't know where the district that you're in or the you know, some states are set up by district, some region, contact your main office and they can put you in contact with a biologist and they'd be happy to tell you, to talk to you about your lake. And chances are, if they're the local biologist, they're going to have that familiarity and probably a history as to, you know, what's going on there. Maybe some things that you may not even know about.
Yeah, no question about it. No question about it. So I want to move on a little bit because I want to talk about, because you're so much stuff. Like you're so full of, your brain is packed full of information that has to get out. So I want to talk about setting up. One of the things you do is put habitat in lakes for fishers to catch fish.
Correct.
You set structure up. You were talking to me before about putting Christmas trees in the lakes and setting up structure for crappie and that sort of thing. Now, in New Hampshire, that's totally legal. No one does it. Well, no one does it legally. But then you're talking about doing it. I'm going, oh, I wish we could do it legally. What are the benefits of setting that habitat up?
Yeah, so in most cases, what you're seeing by doing the habitat is there's potential for increased reproduction, but really the take home is that it's a place to give fish some cover. So for anglers, that's a place where they can go and cover orienting fish such as crappie or bass, at times catfish even. They will use those structures, and then it's a good place for those fish. For the fish to go, and a lot of times, you know, the prey fish will be hanging around and they'll use it as cover to then ambush the prey. Mm-hmm. So it really has those benefits to it. But, you know, in our reservoirs here, we have a lot, and some of them, we have a lot of shoreline development. Some of them we don't have as much just natural habitat in them, you know, 'cause they're reservoirs. And so it provides that habitat that might be occurring in a more natural situation. It gives us anglers a place to go and kind of concentrate their efforts a little bit.
Well, so I'm curious. So the lakes in North Carolina, do you have mostly natural lakes or do you have all man-made lakes? What's your habitat like?
We are very much man-made. We have some natural lakes out in the eastern part of the state called the Bay Lakes, Lake Matamesquite, Lake Phelps, Lake Waccamaw in the very eastern part of the state are, and there's some smaller ones along with that are natural lakes. But most of our lakes, if you will, I put that in quotes, are actually reservoirs. The vast majority of them are.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of states in the South like that. New Hampshire, we're full of natural lakes, so it's maybe that's why they discourage you putting habitat in because the habitat's there naturally. So, but in North Carolina, you guys have apps out where you can like find those man-made reefs or places where fish might live, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, so it's pretty simple. If you go to the app-based version of our webpage, which is ncwildlife.org, ncwildlife is all one word. One of the options there, I don't have my phone in front of me, but is where to fish. And if you click on that, one of the options you can get is a map, an online map of the fish attractors that are out there. And it'll center you, you know, based on where you're at the time. And then it'll also allow you to use a drop-down menu or scroll across the map or whatever, however you want to interface with that to find those. And then the other option out there, which is on our website too, it's actually on the formal website on the non mobile part of it, I guess, is if you have a depth finder on your boat and you'd like to just download the whole coverage and put it in your boat, put it on your depth finder or your GPS unit if you're fishing out of a kayak, you can do that as well. We have them all the coordinates there, and it tells you, you know, what lake they are, and it actually tells you what kind of structure it is. So,
do you fish?
I do. I don't fish as much as I used to. I have two teenage girls that play softball. So pretty competitively, the younger one does. So my fishing days are kind of in a little bit of an ebb right now. I did many years ago and hoping once I get these girls on off to college.
Once they get the hell out of my house.
Yeah, that I'll probably pick it back up a little bit. So I don't get to fish as much as I used to, but I do.
I've got two daughters as well. Now, what part of North Carolina are you living in?
So I live in Albemarle, North Carolina, which if you look at a map, you think Albemarle Sound, northeast part of the state. That's actually not true. I live an hour east of Charlotte. So
oh, perfect. The reason I'm asking is because my brother and sister-in-law live in Charlotte. And whenever I go down there, all they want to do is go golfing or go racetrack watching.
Yeah.
And that sounds, both those things are awful. So when I come down, I would like you to take me fishing.
Okay. All right. If I can't, I know some people that are better at it than I am in that area. But
I don't care if you're good at it. I just want to go fishing.
The Catawba River is right there, literally. I mean, in the backyard of Lake Norman, and you got Lake Wiley.
Because Charlotte's a terrible town. Like, it's an awful place. So I'm game for whatever. Like, I hate Charlotte so much. It's like, it's all banks and nothing to do. Like, there's one bar called the Bar Charlotte that has a riding bull, and that's the only thing good about the whole town.
Well, I'm gonna not touch that. Charlotte, I was a district biologist.
I'm on record.
Yeah, I was the district biologist over Charlotte for a long time. So, of Mecklenburg County. So, yeah, there's some good resources. In fact, as I mentioned, and I think we might talk about it in a minute about trout stocking, but that's one of the places we just stocked trout today was in Charlotte. So, right in the middle of town,
right by the Target.
No, but
17 targets.
Yeah, no, right in McAlpine Creek, which is I'm gonna do my Charlotte geography here. It's in the little bit of the south and east corner of Charlotte. So
perfect. I want to quickly talk about your specialty, which is fishing impoundment.
And yeah, that's what I've studied.
Yeah, so let's define an impoundment first. What's an impoundment?
So just an impoundment is any body of water that's man-made, that's going to have some kind of water control structure, most likely a dam. That's going to be an impoundment.
So I was visualizing like small impoundments, like small urban areas where they've got like a small dam or something like that, but you're talking any of them.
Yeah. So I think kind of the working definition and the break point between what we would call a small impoundment and what we would call a reservoir. And there's multiple ways to slice it up, but anything about 500 acres and less, we consider a small impoundment, and anything bigger than that, we consider a reservoir. So,
okay. All right, cool. Yeah. All right. And so why did you choose impoundments as your focus?
Yeah. So growing up, I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, surrounded by a couple of impoundments. And as it just so happened, once I got my undergraduate degree, really the path of a fisheries biologist, without getting too far off the beaten path, so to speak, is you go to school, you get an undergraduate degree, and then typically to become a biologist, you need to get a master's degree at least. And so when I was looking around the Southeast at potential positions, the one that interested me most and kind of fit me the best was a position at Tennessee Tech University in Cookeville, Tennessee, working on largemouth bass and spotted bass in a reservoir there. And there were a lot of researchers that I was interested in that I had followed for several years that were doing a lot of reservoir research. And so, as it turned out, I was able to get the position, go do the project, get my degree. When I came back to North Carolina, my first job was really a mixed bag. We had trout streams, we had a few reservoirs, we had some smallmouth bass rivers. And then in 2000, when I got promoted to district biologist, I came to the south central part of the state, Charlotte and east, where we had two major river drainages that were heavily impounded. So I've spent a lot of time working on reservoirs. And when I was a district biologist, that was, it was kind of my beat. That was kind of the area that I covered, was mostly reservoirs. We had Lake Norman, which is the largest reservoir in the state, 32,000 acres. And then we had High Rock Lake, which is the second, which is about 16,000 acres, 16 to 18,000 acres. So that's kind of, it was kind of an interest of mine, but it also was sort of necessitated by the work areas that I was in as well.
Yeah. Sounds like a good match. So primary species, you were talking bass species, but there must be other species of fish you chased out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Largemouth bass are, probably the one that everyone's most familiar with across the United States, but certainly crappie, mostly black crappie here. We do have a few white crappie populations. And then as I said earlier, I think if I didn't, we stock striped bass in a lot of our reservoirs. They don't reproduce, but it's a, what we call a put, grow, and take fishery.
Put and take. Yep.
Yeah. And so they'll we do that. And then
you got stripers, you get like white perch or white bass.
We've got both actually. Yeah.
And those are all related. Those are all the same family.
Yes. They're all the same genus actually. Yep. They're all Moroni. And so white perch actually in some of our reservoirs probably were native. They were impounded, and some of them they were placed in there after the impoundments.
For listeners who don't know, white perch and white bass and stripers are all naturally anadromous fish, but they can be landlocked. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, white bass were brought in from the Mississippi drainage, and they're not typically anadromous, but definitely
really?
White perch. Yeah, white bass are not, but white stripers definitely are, and white perch in North Carolina, where you find them mostly in their native range, they are down in the coastal areas. That's where they're native to.
Yeah, and we have native up in New Hampshire, too. We've got sea run, and then they're also landlocked in our biggest lakes, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones in New Hampshire, in Lake Winnipesaukee, for example, are among some of the largest in the world. They get to 5 pounds for white perch.
Wow.
They're huge.
That is a large white perch, yeah.
And that is not abnormal.
No, that's crazy, because I think for us, a 2-pounder is really big.
And it's the only lake in New Hampshire where they're big. They're all, everywhere else are maybe a pound. So
yeah.
One lake is special. There's something about it.
But the other species we do have is we have some catfish species. Some again introduced.
Cats, blue cats, what do you got?
Yep, channels, blues, and flatheads in most of our reservoirs. And you know, again, if we had to do it all over again, we put the blues and the flatheads in as biologists in the 60s and 70s. In some places, in other places, they've made their way there through other introductions. People have moved them, but in some places, we definitely know we did. But they're self-sustaining populations in those reservoirs, and you know, for instance, up on the Virginia border, Lake Gaston, I'm not sitting in front of my record sheet right now, but we just set the state record for a blue catfish that was, 100 and plus some odd pounds,
That's a fish that could eat a person. That's so big.
It's pretty big. Yeah.
So big.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to certify one previous to that was, 89 pounds. And that record's since been broken up there at Gaston. So that's a real popular blue catfish fishery right now up on the border.
That's amazing. And now if people want more information on fishes of North Carolina or information about what you're doing, where can they find that?
Yeah, the best place to go look is our website, which is again, www.nc, and that's all one, NC Wildlife. That's all one word, no spaces, .org. And you kind of can just start on there and start going through the links. And, we're trying all the time to update our information so that it's fairly current.
Perfect. And next time I'm in North Carolina, I'm going to call you and you're going to hook me up, because I would like it much better if I was fishing and not golfing.
You've got my number, you got my email, you're welcome to give me a call. I'd love to meet you in person.
Perfect. You want to stick around and do some news with me?
Sure, I can hang around.
All right, hang on. I'm going to play some news music here for you. Oh, wrong music. Here we go.
News, fish in the news. Everybody loves their fish in the news.
All right, everybody loves the fish in the news. I'm glad I have a biologist with me here for fish in the news. So this is actually from your state, North Carolina State University, NCSU.
That is where I got my undergraduate degree from.
Perfect. And I'm going to read you an abstract. There's a whole article, but we're going to pull this abstract apart because it's really interesting. In some fisheries, releases are a high percentage of total catch. Recent tagging data of marine fishes have revealed that recapture of the same individual multiple times occurs frequently. We investigated the magnitude of the phenomenon and its effect on survival using previously collected mark recaptured data of 4 reef species. I know you're a freshwater guy.
Mm-hmm.
We used Cox proportional hazard regression models to examine whether survival varied with release number. For 3 of 4 species, survival was significantly higher after the second, third, or fourth release as compared to the first release, perhaps resulting from selection for robust individuals. So what they were doing is they were trying to collect fish and data information from people who were actually fishing, and they were finding they were catching the same fish over and over, and that was skewing their data. So they were actually finding that fish seemed to be, once they were caught once, their survival rate to catch a second time or third time was higher.
And in the wildlife world, that's called terrestrial wildlife. That's called trap happy animals, is what they're called. So
you've heard this before.
Yeah, like I said, I've not seen it quite so much in what we do, but I definitely know, in wildlife studies, when they're out trapping, doing small mammal trapping or something like that, it's not uncommon to see an animal that keeps coming back to the traps even after it's been trapped several times and released. So.
Well, they're finding that because of that, they're overestimating populations of fishes. So now they've looked back at the data they had before and wonder, are their fisheries data accurate? Because you know, they were assuming every fish they caught was a unique new fish.
Yep.
And if you're collecting your data on that information, and you can't extrapolate the whole thing. And they were finding that a lot of fish died on release. Obviously, if it dies, you're not going to catch it a second time. But
right.
But these fish that were strong enough to handle release the first time were fine with a second, third, and fourth release.
Yeah, and that's and so what you're talking about there is there's a lot of levels to that. So the one challenge that I don't necessarily have that the marine fisheries biologists have is, so most of my systems are closed. In other words, you know, I have a river flowing through it, but that's pretty much it. You know, if a fish can't get above a dam or below a dam, or even in some of our natural lakes where there's limited connectivity with streams, maybe the fish can go in and out at some level. But in marine systems, you know, they're totally open. So,
and the fish, there. Yeah.
Right. And the fish don't understand political boundaries or geographic boundaries.
No one put a map in front of them?
No. And so that's something that when marine researchers are trying to do these estimates, and they do it a lot because, again, they're trying to scale this out to the entire stock of whatever species of fish they're looking at. Those are issues as to, you know, how accurate are the models, as you said. So it's definitely something that you know, we look at and what we do, but it's even more important with what they do because of the scale of it.
I find it fascinating. And more interesting is like freshwater fishers versus saltwater fishers. I find that saltwater fishers seem to eat more fish that they catch. So I find it more interesting that they're releasing fish.
Yeah. And I think it, a lot of times it depends on the situation. Obviously there's regulations that play into that at times, whether they can keep them or not. But then there are certain fish that I guess just, you know, are more desirable to anglers to eat. So that plays into it. And that's something biologists consider, you know, what is the release, the catch and release rate? For instance, I'll just give you an example. I was just looking at some data today, that we generated here. And this is probably not surprising for people that largemouth bass fish, but the release rate or the inverse of that, which is harvest rate of largemouth bass, the harvest rate is extremely low.
Yeah. People don't eat them.
In our system. They yeah. don't. They
but
don't.
They're delicious. They should eat them, but they don't.
They don't. Yeah. And so, for instance, you flip that over and you're talking about a crappie, mm-hmm. that relationship doesn't, you know, hold the same. They're more likely to get taken home and eaten. And so
like people keep their limit on crappie, but even though they can keep bass, they choose not to.
Yep.
Yeah, we hold bass up on this weird pedestal. Like it's this strange, like overvalue of a fish, I think.
Well, yeah, I think there's, and we've had some discussions recently with anglers about this, is that, so the catch and release ethic, which really, I guess, was started probably by Bassmaster, you know, and that organization and sort of mushroomed out, was good intentioned, and it was sort of the counter to the idea that you know, whatever you catch you take home. In reality, there's a balance in there, so there are some systems that, you know, do need harvest. They need some fish to be taken out, and harvest is not a bad thing. It shapes a population in many ways in a positive way. Now, again, you can flip that pendulum to the other end where you're over harvesting to the point that you're limiting the number of individuals out there, or you're cutting off their growth history. In other words, they get to a legal size limit and then all of them get taken out. And so when you look at the population as a whole, you don't see many fish over the size limit. But that really doesn't occur very often, and particularly in bass populations. So, so there is a balance out there, and that's something we try to stress to people.
Well, that's really cool, and it's so interesting to me. Like any catch and release, I don't think we do enough research on catch and release, and I find that very fascinating how that all works out, and how some fish do well with catch and release, and some seem to fail at it. So, thank you so much for that. So, you guys are stocking trout. This is your news now.
Yeah,
you are stocking trout now in North Carolina.
Yeah, and so, Grant, I'm here, and so I'm most familiar with this, but I'm familiar that, you know, Missouri's doing it. So if you have listeners in Missouri, Tennessee, Virginia, just to name a few, I'm sure there's some other states I'm going to miss and hope they're offended.
I mean, in northern states right now, like New Hampshire, for example, they just stocked all the trout right before the lakes freeze.
Ah.
They dump them in, and the lakes freeze over. Then as soon as it's safe to walk on ice, we go out and catch them.
Yeah, we don't have the ice fishing here. So
you're missing out.
I know. My in-laws lived in Canada for about 20 years, and I never got to go ice fishing. So, but So for us, it's an opportunity to create a fishery that doesn't exist during the warm water months because these fish wouldn't survive at all. And so these are hatchery raised fish that in the
is that another make and take fishery?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So do you encourage people just to keep them?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because once it gets warm in the spring, the thermal conditions are going to not be suitable for them and they would die of natural causes. So we definitely encourage people
natural
to catch.
Cause being hot water and no oxygen. That's
correct. Yeah. Yep. Correct. And so we definitely encourage them to take them home if they want. I mean, there are people that do like to go out and catch and release them, but, there's, at least in our state, and I think most states are set up this way, it's a 7 fish per day creel, and there's no size limit, and there's no lure restrictions. So, which, you know, when you get into trout fishing, particularly on streams, I know in our state we have different classifications in terms of regulations, and so this is really...
That's a lot of fish, by the way. 7 trout's a lot of trout to keep.
Yeah, that's been the limit here for as long as I can remember. On our hatchery supported streams. Now on our wild streams, it's different. It's 4 on wild streams.
So New Hampshire is depending on the lake, but general rules are 5 fish or 5 pounds, whichever happens first. And then ice fishing, it's 2 fish or 5 pounds. So
wow,
and so it's just bizarre, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, for us, like we're going to be stocking 38 impoundments, small impoundments. These are smaller lakes. These are, you know, way under, you know, 100 acres or less impoundments. For the most part, there might be a couple that are over that, but for the most part, these are lakes and parks and small towns and even large towns. Even Raleigh and Charlotte are getting them.
And what kind of trout are you stocking?
All 3 species. We're stocking rainbow trout, brown trout, and brook trout. It's a mixture. That's typical for our hatchery supported trout program in North Carolina.
That's pretty typical for most places, those 3
species. Yeah. One of the interesting things, and this doesn't really apply to the impoundments, this program, because these fish wouldn't reproduce, but because of genetic concerns and some of the things we talked about introducing fish and that, all of our trout that we stock are triploid. They're sterile. So even in our hatchery supported streams, those fish aren't able to reproduce.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yep.
And that's just sealed up just in case.
Yep. Because we in North Carolina, and I could get my colleague, Jake Rash, who's our trout biologist on trout coordinator on here, and he could talk to you for 2 hours about it,
but I'm sure he could.
But our trout, you know, the brook trout, Southern Appalachian brook trout is our only native salmonid in the state. And so there's a lot of concerns about protecting and even going back and trying to reestablish some of those populations where we can. And so we're kind of hesitant now to put, you know, trout that could reproduce in those systems, particularly rainbow and brown, because they're not supposed to occur here naturally. And then,
well, no, your rainbows are from California and your browns are German. So they've no right. business there. Yeah.
Right. But they do provide a really good fishing opportunity. And especially like since we've got, you know, the ability now to make them sterile, it's a win-win. And so, but in our impoundments in the winter time, we're stocking, I think I just saw today, 38 impoundments, and about 60,000 fish are going to go out over the next month. And so that's, like I said, there's other states doing that. So if you're in one of those,
do people in North Carolina have access to the data? They know where you're stocking.
Yes, that is on our website. We put a press release out typically about 3 weeks out.
You mean after you stock or before?
No, before. Really? Before. In fact, it's
so funny because New Hampshire, they announced the stocking numbers 3 weeks after it's happened.
Yeah, so on this one, it's a little different, and I guess I need to explain. Normally, on our hatchery-supported streams that get stocked, we don't pre-announce. What we do is typically every Friday it's updated for that past week. So anglers have an idea of what was stocked that previous week, and we do that so that if folks are trying to plan their weekend out and they're looking at where they might want to go, they can see some streams that were recently stocked and maybe shape their trip that way.
It's a good, you know, people buying their fishing licenses, spending money on fishing gear, it's all really good for the state. So
Oh, it's good for yeah, it definitely is. I mean, it's what, you know, pays our salary is, you know, the licenses and then the excise taxes that are collected. And again, that could be a whole nother show. But we definitely, appreciate anglers, you know, spending their money because it does support a lot of things that, again, maybe they don't even know sometimes they're supporting. So,
well, that's amazing. And that is Fish in the News. I'm going to push this button here now.
News, Fish in the News. Everybody loves their Fish in the News.
Well, Lawrence, you've done it. You've made Fish in the News. You were a guest on the Fish Nerds podcast. Any parting thoughts?
No, I'd just like to say thanks for the opportunity to be on here. Sure. As I mentioned to you earlier, we, you know, we're all the time looking to connect with anglers. You have my contact information. Feel free to share that and feel free to use it. And
can I keep you on deck? So if I get a fish with a question, I can call you up and get answers.
Sure. Yeah. And if I can't answer it, or if I know somebody that I think's got a better base for answering the question, I can refer you to them. So
I don't mind doing that. I don't like them. I like you.
Okay. Okay. Well, I can get the answer for you from them and then give it back to you.
Yeah. Those jerks. All right. So awesome. Well, thank you so much for being guest tonight on the show. Thank you, Lawrence. We appreciate your time and thanks for coming on the podcast. And now I want to really thank the people who make the podcast possible. We could not, literally could not make the show without our Patreon supporters. If you want to give some money to the show, we really could use it. Patreon.com/fishnerds to make a donation. And anyone who donates at the $5 a month level will be entered into a monthly drawing for a Fish Nerds prize package. I know I owe the November winner the prize still, so send me an email. Remind me. I'll send it out to you. But today's prize is going to be a Fish Nerds hat and a book and a package of Glasswater lead-free lures from our friend the Crappy Hippie. You can go to crappyhippie.com to buy your own set of lures, but we love fishing lead-free, and we're so happy to do that. So we'll get that out, and the winner is Bethany Metz. So I'll make sure she gets her prize. And we're going to read everyone's name here now because I do that once in a while. So let me thank you by name. Chuck Hobble, thank you so much for the donation. Darren Radcliffe, thank you. Nathan Otto, you're a hero. James Paul M, I don't have a last name there. Thank you. Brian Barber, and the Knitting Daddy himself. Greg Cahoon is here. Luke Ovgaard, thank you. Kevin Jones, Gregory Sitzman, thank you, both of you. Kate, with no last name, you're a hero. She makes a podcast. IWB. Oh, Kate, Internet. Ignorance is Bliss podcast. Thank you, Kate. Dave Williamson, thank you. Manga Bay, the news site, gives us money, and we appreciate them. Tim Beat, of course, true hero here. Joe Pardo, Super Joe Pardo, we thank you. Matt Philippi, thanks. Olaf Nelson, true hero. Chandler, oh, I don't have a last name on here. Why does it not show me last names? It's a funny program. Chandler Dobson, thank you so much. Cody Fondy, thank you. Christopher Englert, thank you. Mark Pieper, haven't talked to you in a long time, Mark, thank you. Mike O'Keefe, Nicholas Craig, thank you guys. Chad O'Leary, Mike Steffen himself, Alan Byrne, thank you. Renegade Clock, which is a podcast. Courtney D, with no last name. Thank you so much, Courtney D, for your donation. We have Anthony DiPolito. Thanks. The Jock and Nerd Podcast gives us $1 a month. Jonathan Sutter, thanks. Lycan Rancourt, you're a hero. Bethany Metz, who won this month, thank you. Sean Bradbury, Ed Hind, thank you guys. Rich Collins, our fly fishing correspondent. Andrew Lewin, thank you, from the Speak Up for Blue Podcast. Kevin Kupczyk. Josh Lopes at LopesTax.com pays us $25 a month. Reed Sutter makes music for us. We like Reed. Fish Guy Josh. Big Buck Registry Podcast gives us money. David Redden, D. Redden. Ray Layton from England. Lindsay Freeman. Jeff Danielson, our FN librarian. And Ryan, all of you, thank you so much for your donation. It makes a big, big difference, and it literally is the only reason we have a podcast. We could not afford to make the show. I don't have a lot of sponsors. I don't make a lot of effort for sponsors. I should. I may in 2021, but currently I don't get excited about calling people and asking for money, so we appreciate you. So that's it. You've listened to a bunch of Fish Nerds when you should have been fishing. Big special thanks to Zoe. Thank you, Zoe. Thanks, Tim Beat and Grace. You guys are true heroes. We thank you for your submission there. Lawrence, Lawrence Dorsey, thanks for coming on the podcast. And, of course, thank you for everyone for listening. Have a great, happy, safe New Year, Fish Nerd Nation. We really appreciate you. Until next time, follow the code of the fish nerd. Spawn early and often. Never trust a free lunch with strings attached. And swim against the current every chance you get.
Well, we're big YouTubers. We've got lots of followers. And we're loved everywhere we go. We talk about fishing and we talk about lures, get cash for videos. We have mad fishing skills that give us all kinds of thrills, but the thrill we've never known is to be broadcast on the Fish Nerds Podcast, be interviewed by Clay Grove.
By Clay Grove.
Wanna hear my voice on the podcast,
Grove.
Then I'd no longer be an outcast.
Grove.
Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove. I go fishing daily, even when it's rainy. Got the best boat you ever seen. Making YouTube videos is easy, just like a cash machine. Now it's all designed to blow our minds, but our minds won't really be blown. Like the nerdy blast when you're on the podcast being interviewed by Clay Grove.
By Clay Grove.
Wanna hear my voice on the podcast,
Grove.
Then I no longer be an outcast,
Grove.
Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove. On the podcast,
Grove.
Then I'd no longer be an outcast.
Grove.
Wanna hear my smiling voice being interviewed by Clay Grove.
Being interviewed by Clay Grove.
Wanna hear my voice on the podcast,
Grove.